ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Do you remember going to work with your parents when you were young? It may have felt like visiting another world. And sometimes it also meant seeing your mum or your dad in a very different way. Hello, Lisa Leong here for This Working Life, helping to make your work life better. Many of you have kids on school holidays right now, and whether you're a parent or a grandparent helping out, it can be a juggle. And it got us thinking, what are your memories about your parents and work, and how have they influenced the way you manage your own work life? You can email thisworkinglife@abc.net.au. Professor Lyndall Strasdens is a clinical psychologist who's been researching the interaction between work and family life for many years at the ANU. Welcome, Lyndall.
Thank you, Lisa. I'm very excited for this discussion.
And John O'Nicholas is the founder and managing director of the Wellbeing Outfit. He's a former CEO of mental health charity Reach Out as well. Hi, Jono.
Hello.
I want to start by asking each of you about your own experience growing up around your parents' work. So, Lyndall, you're up first. Please share.
Yeah, so interesting. So without revealing how old I am, I grew up in the generation where fathers were mostly breadwinners and mothers were mostly at home.
Mm. What did your dad do?
He was an engineer and he invented things. So he had a firm where he designed things, then sold them.
And did he work in an office?
Yes. He had an office in the factory. He was a very creative man. He was very he actually seemed to really like his work, and yet despite being the person who basically earned all the money for the family, his working hours, I would say, were far lower than most people's these days.
Can you describe the working hours and conditions? Like, how often would you see him?
Yeah, so he was a small businessman. He worked very hard by anyone's reckoning, but he would probably head off to work around 8:30. He's European, so he'd come home for lunch and have his lunch. Sometimes he'd have a rest. And then he'd go back to work and then come home around 5:36. And that was that.
And so tell me about his attitude to work and what he might have taught you about work.
Well, what I observed about him, he was a very sort of humble man, actually, and his work was creative. He liked to feel successful, but he seemed to be fairly relaxed about work. I didn't see him angry about his work. I didn't see him anxious about his work. And I know his work would have had ups and downs, but he generally just had a very steady, I'll do this and I'll do my best. And he was proud of what he produced. So he had a really very positive attitude to work, and he saw that as his job.
Mm. So how did that experience actually influence your own work and career then, Lyndall?
Yeah, so I think it's more complicated because in comes gender. So obviously he was a man, and he and I hardly ever talked about what my jobs or my future would be, but his attitude to me was, go and marry someone who's got money.
Right.
So his message was like, go away and enjoy your life and marry someone who's got money. And that really clashed with what I knew was my future, because I knew that I would have to earn my own money, and that was something I both wanted to do, but also I could see would be what I had to do. So there was this strange disconnect between what he imagined for me and what I was encountering as I grew up.
So, Jono, let's turn to you now. And can you tell us a little bit about your parents and what they did for work?
Yeah, my mother was a school teacher and school principal, so, a very long career in education, particularly primary education. And my dad was an academic and then had a private practice in psychology. And I think when I reflect on it, it was interesting their stories being really different. So probably not dissimilar, say, than Lyndall's story. My mum was really affected by the fact that her father, she got a scholarship to do journalism, but the really only appropriate career for women at that time was in education. So she kind of felt like she missed her career, if that makes sense. Mm. And then went in and out of the workforce because at that time you really couldn't get maternity leave. So her kind of story was very much, I think, the story of many women of that generation in Australia, of moving in and out of the workforce without a lot of flexibility and without a lot of control, but still being very, very dedicated to her career. And my father was a refugee after World War II from Malta, really struggled economically. So both of them were really driven, particularly my dad, I would say, and continues to be, like, economic security and just a belief that you have to work hard. And I remember them both being very, very affected by the very high interest rates, having to move, not lose their house, but change locations. And so economic security was a really big part of our working story. But then my dad started his own practice in his mid-40s, and that was really successful. So that was a really big change in career from academia.
And Donna, how do you think your parents' experience then influenced your own work and career?
Yeah, I'd say that the most interesting one is I never really expected, and I'd say for my sister and my brother as well, that you wouldn't go to university. So the idea of intellectual pursuits rather than kind of physical pursuits were really big. My father often spoke about my grandfather saying that he didn't want any of his children and grandchildren to have calluses on their hands because he believed that was a way out. So we were really affected by that kind of story. And I think for me the idea of you've just got to do it yourself as a really big part of the story.
Now, we're in the middle of school holidays for some, and so we're talking about that juggle that you get of work and family. How have you handled the juggle yourself?
I look at it, I'm really in two phases. So I've got three boys. My youngest now is 11 through 16. So when we were really young, my wife was far more sort of flexible in work, and then when I stepped down as CEO of Reach Out, my youngest was 5 or 6, and part of the idea of starting the wellbeing outfit was not only a continuation career, but really the idea that I could be more flexible, and she really wanted, I guess, kind of more certainty in the sense of career development. So that was a really interesting and big flip. And so I say that in the sense of school holidays of, you know, we really in that awesome juggle, but probably coming out of the end of it, right? Where where I kind of saying to my kids, am I going to see you today and do you want dinner? Rather than can I get you into school activities or after school activities and all the complexity that comes with that during school holidays.
Lyndall, how have you handled the juggle of work and family?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. As you may know, Lisa, it's been my research field. So I have been immersed in understanding and thinking about it and writing about it for about 20 years or more. So when I had both my kids, so just full disclosure here, they're not living at home now and they're well and truly grown up. But with both my kids, I had them when I was doing a degree, which allowed me to be flexible. And so my son, who's my oldest, I had him when I was doing my Master's of Clinical Psych. And then my daughter, I had her when I did my PhD. So I had them where I had maximum flexibility, but unfortunately I had no money and also no time. So on one hand, it was a good idea to have babies while I was studying. But on the other hand, it was awfully, awfully hard on all of us to cope with just the time pressure and the financial pressure of studying but not pulling in much. I mean, I worked a little bit while I was studying, but not enough really to support the family. So that was tough. And then as I turned into an academic, the work hours are very, very long and the competition is enormous, it seemed really clear to me that if I really wanted to walk the talk, I should not work like that. So I made a decision early on in my career that my family was vitally important to me and that my work was not going to take my time off my family, and I was going to work my full-time hours, maximum 40 hours a week and no more. So I have very, very, very strict boundaries about my work. And I worked part-time when the kids were up to about one or two, but then from then on it was a very strict 40 hours a week. And everyone said to me, career suicide, Lyndall. But it felt like I had no other option. That if I had let those boundaries go, I would have been bad for me and bad for my kids. So that's how I managed it. And I stuck to it, and it wasn't easy, but it felt really important to take that stand as a mother and as also someone who wanted to be a breadwinner and support the family.
Lisa Leong here for This Working Life on ABC Radio National. You're listening to Professor Lyndall Strasden from ANU and John O'Nicholas, Managing Director of the Wellbeing Outfit. What are your memories about your own parents and work, and how have they influenced the way you manage your own work life? Would love to hear from you. You can email thisworkinglife@abc.net.au. Selena says, I'm so, so grateful to my parents who alternated their shift work across the week and weekends to set up a great life in Australia. It would have been very lonely for them at times. This has allowed me the flexibility of work hours in a job I love, but they are also very happy to support me during the school holidays with the kids. And a smiley face emoji there. Thank you, Selena. Virginia writes, my father worked at ABC Radio as one of the chiefs of staff. When I visited him, he would prop me up next to the CB radio for the shift and say, if you hear police or fire, come and get me. Cub cadet. Thank you, Virginia. Beautiful memory there. Let's hear now from Sarah, who sent us this voice memo.
I grew up in the family business, working behind the till at my parents' gift store. And my favourite memory is going on a Hong Kong buying trip with Mum in the school holidays. But I could see how stressful it was. They worked most weekends without much financial return, and I swore I'd never run my own business. I wanted the security of a paycheck and to wear a fancy suit. Eventually, though, I realised I wanted the freedom to build something of my own. So when I started my copywriting agency, I initially followed Dad's advice: no walls, no stock, no staff. And then I did hire staff, but I've carefully managed the financial risk, and my kids have grown up in a very different business, and I've loved having them help out at events and in the office.
Jono, any reflections from you on hearing from Sarah?
It sounds familiar in terms of starting my own business. My oldest boy, Arlo, now works after school with us sort of 6 to 8 hours a week and doing lots of things. So I think one of the joys of having your own business is that idea of flexibility, right? That you are responsible to the business but not responsible to an external authority, and the freedom then to kind of run it your way. And that's really nice. So I think one of the things that I learned is really interesting, having a career in charity and as a CEO of a charity, starting my own business actually I found was not nearly as fearful as it was for other people, because I was used to running a very insecure business, if that makes sense,
yeah.
in charity. Used to asking people for money, often kind of joke that you're running a charity, you ask for money and don't give anything in return other than good feelings. So the idea of giving people a service in return sort of felt strangely much easier. So that for me felt that by the time I had staff recruitment, I'd already had a sense of how do you do it, and it wasn't nearly as a bigger concern as perhaps some other people might have.
Let's zoom out now and talk about context on how those memories were created and how they might influence the next generation. So, Lyndall, what do we know about the influence of our parents on our work habits?
Well, so the two most important things for kids is what they learn about work from their family and what they begin to learn from school. And then as they get a lot older, maybe peers come into it, family and school are the biggies. And it's really important to understand there's what parents say, but there's also very powerfully what parents do. And that the extent there's a disconnect with that is important. So, you know, people imagine that kids don't really notice parents' job. The listeners that you've said, and, you know, from Jono and I, it's clear that we observe our parents and their work really closely. So we know that kids are very aware of their parents' job, and they're very aware of how their job affects their parents. So they're very aware of how parents feel about their job. They're very aware of whether their parents like their job, and they're very aware of whether they think their job's important. So I'm just looking at some data here from the Australian longitudinal study of Australian children, which asks children about what do they think of the value of their father's job. I also asked about mothers, so I've got the father's data here. And children, you know, most children are very aware about their father, and most of them think their father's pretty enthusiastic about their job, about nearly half of them.
Mm-hmm.
Most children, nearly half of them, think their dad likes work, and about half of kids think their father's job, their father thinks his job's important. But there's a downside to that, which is there's also quite a few children who, in case of fathers, feel their job, their father works too much. And so for many children, they're not only aware of how their parents, you know, feel about their job, but they're very aware about the impact of that parent's job on family life. And there's beautiful research showing how kids even try and help their parents with their work and try and take the stress off them. So the extent that parents bring home stress and are pressured by their jobs, and a lot of parents are, this is a reality of the 21st century. Jobs are tough, and having households where both people working puts even more pressure on families. Children are very aware of those impacts and they think about them.
Lyndall, when there is a big change, is it better to discuss it as a family and with children, or is it better not to discuss the issues or the problems or the concerns that you might have with your children? I can see that both sides might have proponents who would argue that one is better than the other. What does the research show us?
Well, what we know about children is how they understand things to change it. So when children are young, they often see the world as them central to the world, which also means they feel that they're at fault when things go wrong. As children get to adolescence, they start to see the world as, you know, different that way. But so talking about jobs being difficult or hard, it's really quite important to combine that with a message that it's not about the child. So it's not their responsibility or even them that's creating that stress or just difficulty. So it's keeping that kind of discussion to, mum's had a bad day today. It's okay. Thanks, honey. I'll go make a cup of tea. So it's kind of parents maybe saying where they're at, but not making sure they're very clear. It's not because their kids have generated that problem for them. As children get older, then I think there's more dialogue about jobs. Oh, you know, these jobs are hard. What do you think? You can turn those conversations about your own job into conversations about what they'd like and what future they want to have. So it just depends very much, Lisa, on how old that kid is. But critically, children really do feel like it's that parents' jobs are part of the family, if you like, and helping them feel okay about those jobs rather than responsible for those jobs is really important in the message.
Lyndall, you've alluded to the fact that the times have changed in terms of the way we work. So there's a lot of conversation about working from home versus returning to the office. That's been debated over the past year or two. We've got a stat for you from a recent ARI report. 70% of organisations now report that they plan to maintain their current hybrid working arrangement over the next 2 years, which compares to 59% in 2023 and 53% in 2022. So, Lyndall, how much have attitudes and policy around flexible work changed over the decades?
They've changed. I'd say they haven't changed enough, but they definitely have changed, and they had to change because our workforce is now pretty much 50% women and 50% men, and large numbers of those men and women have some sort of care as well as a job. So there's a seismic shift in who's actually working, and we've got a lag in catching up. But what we are seeing is we sort of started slow here with like, all right, let's make some jobs that could be more family friendly. So they've got, you know, some maternity or paternity leave, they've got some flexibility and they're part-time. But in the end, we need to change all jobs to be family friendly, not just some jobs. So there's work to do on that part of it, but we have changed a great deal. And one of the things people realise is that parents face these impossible dilemmas between working or caring. And that's such a huge problem for our economy as well as for those families. So jobs are sort of they're on a catch-up project with flexibility and changing work. Really important that we don't talk about this as something that's only for women. There are so many men who want to be more engaged, have more time with their children, be the fathers they want to be, and we need to start changing their jobs as well.
Jono, what have you observed about the willingness of employers to be flexible, like in school holidays, for example?
I would say there was a real watershed. It wasn't really a moment. It was a number of years in COVID where for employers, the myth that you have to be in a certain location 5 days a week was burst wide open. And it changed the relationship between people in their workplace, employers and their employees. They felt a lot more connected online, talking about well-being. We had a sense of a shared experience. And now, certainly if you look at all the data and work in Australia, people don't want to revert back to that kind of pre-COVID idea of we have to be in a central location all the time. I think it's really important to understand for people I work with, we often have a really strong bias to return to the office on the assumption of that's actually where people work. And one of the stories that is always there that men quite often feel left out is if their workplace is not represented in that conversation, that if they're working particularly in physical labour or as a driver, truck driver, or working in multiple locations, they often feel like that conversation is there and get very, very angry, would be my experience. You know, absolutely, coming with Lyndall, I think one of the things that I've noticed in workplaces and supporting workplaces and employers is actually there's a very significant generational shift. If you're talking about people under 40, men have now had an experience of being there when their kids are very young that perhaps older generations, I'm 50, that I wouldn't have had. And they don't want to let that go either. And I think a lot of the decision makers are predominantly people in their 50s and predominantly male, and it's really hard for them to bridge their experience of when they were young, or they had heavier caring duties, if that makes sense, for kids, with what other people want. And so they still, to Lyndall's point, they still see flexibility, at least for a number of employers, as a gender equity question rather than as a employee preference.
Lyndall, you've just published a research paper showing how important men's hours are to women's decisions about work. Can you tell us about it, please?
Yeah, sure. So this was a really interesting paper. It was led by Tim Doan, who's an econometrician, and also with my colleague, Liana Leach. And basically, we looked at households and we said, well, in Australia, men work long hours, and of course, they earn the big bucks in the long hours, and women tend to work shorter hours, independent of how well educated or they are. And that's a compromise for the household to try and, you know, manage work and care. So we asked, how would women's work hours change and men's work hours change if women didn't do that extra household work? If men and women shared that much more equally, what would be the flow on to how men worked and how women worked? And what we found was that men's work hours would reduce by about 5 hours and women's would move up by about 5 hours. So with the hour gap between men and women in a family would close quite a lot if there was more equal sharing right there. But really interestingly, so would the earnings gap. The earnings gap would go down to about a third of what it was. So a huge reduction in that, you know, difference in earnings and a convergence of working hours. They're still not exactly the same. And then the equal sharing of the care underneath that. So if we could change how we share care and paid work, we could do a huge amount towards advancing gender equality and women's earnings.
Jono, what lessons do you hope young people are learning about the future of work?
I think they're really learning probably very a complex set of lessons. The first is that actually going and being with other people is lots of fun. You know, so if you look at that generation who were really reached adulthood around the time of COVID, spent way too much time in the house, didn't do enough adventuring, I'm seeing this real kind of, oh, wow, offices actually can be quite fun, going out with, you know, people after work and having a good activity. So there's this real sense of reconnecting with the world around you, and work is a wonderful way to do that, and sitting at home on Zoom or whatever isn't necessarily as enjoyable, even if you get the freedom. And I think the second thing that we're really struggling with now, which is the nature of a lot of workplaces, is under fundamental transformation with AI. And that's probably the biggest thing that we're now seeing, which is, what are the sorts of tasks that will be replaced that will again change our relationship to work and each other and how we spend time? And that I'm seeing that washing through in big changes in over a matter of months.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Jono, and thank you so much, Lyndal, for your time today. Lyndal, in 30 seconds, why is it useful to actually reflect on the influence of society on our work life and choices?
Because I think, well, I think it's, I'd really encourage everyone to have more conversations, and for parents to be having more conversations with their kids, and for employers to be thinking about this as well, and seeing that how they behave affects generations, not just their immediate workforce.
That's Professor Lyndal Strasdens, a clinical psychologist who's been researching the interaction between work and family life for many years at the ANU, and Jono Nicholas, founder and managing director of the Wellbeing Outfit. Well, this week we made a special bonus podcast episode of Try This. It's called How to Nail a Performance Review. Here's our expert, Emma Power, on how to handle the feedback you get in a performance review when it's negative.
Really understand whose perspective is that coming from. Give me some examples. Because sometimes, I mean, you've got one person's view, don't you? You've got two people in the meeting. It's one person against the other. What we're trying to do is actually get data. So show me kind of the results that you've been indicating that that's the case. Who actually has been saying this? Do you have some 360-degree feedback, for example? Do we have some client satisfaction scores? Do we have some clear results that you can peg to that? Because we don't want a he said, she said situation.
Thanks, Emma Power. Check out the whole bonus episode and let us know how your next performance review goes by emailing us at thisworkinglife@abc.net.au. Thank you so much for spending time with me, Lisa Leong, on This Working Life. And if you haven't already, search for This Working Life on the ABC Listen app. Tap the heart to follow. This episode was produced by Michelle Weeks and engineered by Matthew Sigley. We're on the lands of the Wurundjeri people in Naarm, Melbourne. And until next time, love your work.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.